Time for Wednesday's hour number two on Hashtag Daily K with your host, Peter Bint. Korean dramas, movies, and even lyrics. Why is the world paying attention to Korean stories?
From classics to modern masterpieces, time to dig deep into the charms of Korean literature.
Oh, check it out.
With Paul.
Gonna be minus 15 tomorrow, but Paul Matthews doesn't care. He's here in his Dalek t-shirt.
Not just Dalek. Who is it?
Oh, I forget his name.
It's Dalek and Calvin and Hobbes.
Calvin and Hobbes.
With
exterminate.
Hobbes dressed as Doctor Number 4 and Calvin dressed as Doctor Number 11?
You know the number of Doctor and their attire. That is unbelievable.
It's my Christmas t-shirt.
Did they ever actually appear in Doctor Who, Calvin and Hobbes?
No, this is a bootleg.
Oh, I love it.
You know why this is my Christmas t-shirt?
Why?
Because Doctor Who's back on at Christmas this year.
Ooh,
on Christmas Day. And I'm just like a little kid again.
Unreleased yet?
Yeah, no, of course. New Doctor, his first full episode on Christmas Day. And that, for me, is what Christmas is all about, Doctor Who.
Is it a tradition to have that on every Christmas?
Ever since it got rebooted in 2005, and then the last couple of years, they didn't have it at Christmas and it wasn't the same.
Oh no, why not? Yeah.
Well, I don't want to get into the details. This is a show about Korean culture and Korean literature.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is my Christmas, because we're coming up to Christmas, it's my Christmas t-shirt for you.
Are there many Doctor Who fans in Korea?
I think there are a fair few, yeah.
Yeah, not like mainstream as much as, like, I don't know, Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch.
No, it's different because I think there's, sci-fi has a smaller fan base in Korea. And also it takes a bit of getting used to all the timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly things.
It is a confusing one. It's a head-scratcher for me. To be honest, I kind of watched a little bit when I was really young with the old-school Daleks. And it was pretty scary,
Hide behind the sofa good.
Yeah, and then I fell away from it for the longest time. I apologise, Doctor.
No, it's fine. Because you're of the generation, because you're a little bit younger than me.
Yeah.
We were cheated out of Doctor Who. Because the time we got to almost our teenage years, it got cancelled for a decade or two.
Yeah.
So it's all right.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Doctor.
Doctor Who?
That is a joke out of a Christmas cracker.
It's a good one.
Can you ever find Christmas crackers, Paul, in Korea?
You can find them. I have seen them on the online markets, but they cost a bomb.
Right.
They are very, very expensive. So I'm doing without the Christmas crackers this year. That said, a parcel from a very good friend, a very old friend in Norway, came yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And she'd been to the UK for a conference.
Yeah.
And she'd sent me things like the little tea cakes and caramel wafers.
Ooh.
And most importantly, she sent me a slice of a certain posh supermarket's Christmas cake.
Wow.
I've got Christmas cake for Christmas, and you can't get it here.
Amazing. Yeah. It is very difficult, isn't it? Today's hashtag that we're talking about is Nangman.
Well, Doctor Who.
The romance
of Doctor Who, the joys of travelling through space and time with your best friends, and also you never die, you just regenerate into someone else.
Does he have, like, romantic entanglements?
There have been sort of ish romantic-y thingies. I mean, he got married at one point to one woman.
He got married?
To Riversong.
And then what happened?
Well, the thing is, she keeps meeting his previous incarnations. You don't actually know that she's married to him, and she has to keep wiping their memories.
Oh, wow. That sounds not romantic at all, wiping memories.
It's very timey-wimey. And the other thing I think of with Nangman is, only for the cat butlers, Nyangman.
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 Nyangman. Nyangy, koyangy is what we call them. Nyangies. Oh, that's nice. As a cat butler yourself, Paul.
Yeah.
And do you think the sentence today, which side of the fence are we on? Nangmani pap mogyojuni. Does romance put food on the table?
Yes.
Yes.
What do I do? I go on the radio and I talk about romantic novels sometimes, and you pay me for it.
That's true. It really puts food on the table for you. Yeah, and I think, you know, being passionate about something, it will lead to a better career as well.
Yeah, right? I got paid good money to translate Romeo and Juliet into English from Korean.
Oh, that is romantic. Yeah. And putting money, food on the table. Maybe money, if you like. Today's book, what are we looking at?
It's not romance, but it is poetry, and it's my early Christmas present to you from one one of my favourite modern Korean poets. Her name is Kim Hae-soon. We featured her on the show a couple of times before. Uh-huh. We've got her regular translator back again, Don Mi Che. And this time we're looking at her most recently published collection, which came out earlier this year, Phantom Pain Wings, 날개 환상통.
Oh dear, that I don't know what to make of that title.
Well, if you remember the previous books I've featured, she's a bit of a confrontational poet. She's okay. Not your sort of, oh, isn't nature lovely? She's more like, isn't life terrible and isn't life horrible and grief and pain and so on and so forth.
Lovely.
But in a very good and very interesting way.
Okay.
And so this collection, it's split into four sections. They're titled My Beloved Parting, I Sharpen the Forest and Write a Letter, Community of Parting, and Why Do Women Think That Animals Can Speak? So those are the four sections of poetry.
Wow.
Plus there's an essay from the poet, and there's a translator's diary that sort of goes behind the scenes of what was going on as she was translating and some of the issues or things she had to really carefully consider as she was translating these poems.
That's amazing. So I guess that's only in the English version as
well. Exactly. So it's a little bonus. And I have to say, if you haven't heard of Don Mi Che, you need to check out her own work as well as her translations. And if you haven't heard of Kim Hae-soon, well, you need to check out her poems.
All right. And you need to keep listening because we'll give you a bit of an introduction to both
yes.
of these.
Kim Hae-soon, I have so much respect for her because she's just a brilliant poet. And she's willing to tackle anything and everything when it comes to her life and her feelings and her thoughts. She was born in Uljin in Gyeongsangbuk-do province in 1955, got a PhD in Korean literature from Gongguk University, and became a published poet in 1979, and she's still going. And she's won all sorts of awards, published more than a dozen collections of poems as well as essays. She's considered to be one of Korea's most important contemporary poets. And she deals with all sorts of these difficult themes to do with Korea, to do with women, to do with life. Mm-hmm. She's talked about the language of women's poetry is internal yet defiant and revolutionary. And her poems are available in English and Chinese and French and German and Swedish and Dutch and more.
Wow.
So go and read them.
She must be approaching 70, but still going strong. Translator Don Mi Che.
Yes, brilliant translator, was born here but now lives in Seattle in the US. She's a translator, but she's also a poet herself, and she's a brilliant poet.
Wow.
I think her most recent book, DMZ Colony, is a must-read if you're interested in avant-garde poetry and how a book becomes a piece of art.
Well, that sounds good.
And so her focus when she's a translator is contemporary Korean women poets. She's translated, I think, maybe six books of Kim Hae-soon's poetry, mm-hmm. including this one. I really respect her as well in the way that she's able to get the feeling of Kim Hae-soon's writing across in English, because this is not just your normal sort of poet. This is a poet who's really playing with really deep ideas and language, and that can be a really difficult thing to get across in another language.
Absolutely. Must be super talented to do it. I guess the background in writing poetry helps. So where are we going to start? Are we doing like a poem from different sections? Or?
I thought about this a lot because choosing poetry is tricky because the poems are related, but they're not related, but they're related, and the sections are different, but they're not different because they're related. So I've picked three poems that deal with familial relationships.
Okay.
Two dealing with a relationship with her mother and one with her grandmother.
Oh.
From three sections of the book.
Okay.
So there are many other poems in the book, and there are poems with all sorts of issues, but I think these are three of my favorites, but I think also they go well together.
Okay, so starting off with one with her mother and her relationship, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, this one is called Flaw Is Not a Flaw. Sparkly silver chains on my ankles. As soon as Mummy hatched, she dressed me in a birdcage. My feet keep sinking into the trampoline night. Like a white aurora, the rabbit-shaped shadow dissipates. I bounce into the trampoline night. Who, when, why, how, where, what? I bounce up, facing the inexplicable face. The shiny moonlight on my silver chains gave birth to Mummy, raised and married her off, then made her have me, and now turns her into a sick, bedridden granny. I stretch my hands out to the moon. Come out! Come out! I'm going to slap your face! I leave Mummy in hospice and I dance a trampoline dance. I don't go to see Mummy, instead I dance, fighting the moon.
My dance slays as I dance. My dance makes loud thumping sounds. Trampoline night, trampoline mountain, trampoline forest. Sink, sink into the rabbit shadow swamp night. I'll fight them. I'll slay them. I'll seduce the mountain. Look here. Drink this. Summer's monsoon juice. End of heatwave typhoon slush. I'll offer it to the forest. Look here, drink this. Cool autumn rain mixed fruit nectar to seduce the giant who lives in the forest. I want to slay the space between sky and land. I want to slay every place except where mummy is lying. I want to slay the rain falling like a black velvet curtain. I want to slay the geraniums under the drops of moonlight. Why did you let mummy be born? And why do you let her die? I can't take off my birdcage dress. It strangles me more each day. I'm entirely dependent on the floor. Trampoline, trampoline. Does my dress bring destruction? Bird wearing birdcage with lace curtains jumps, jumps. Is sorrow choreographing my dance or is it anxiety? Lies begin in the morning. They do hurdles, high jumps. Lies begin at night. They fall over, do forward rolls. My silver anklets clang. They say Earth revolves and rotates, orbiting, swirling like my skirt. So why should mummy die? Why? Moonlight soaks me like ink, pocking my whole body. Will death stop if I slay all the moonlight? I fight, still wearing my birdcage, with forest, with mountain, with night. If I slay them all, will mummy live?
Siska asks a question. I didn't get this feeling.
Okay, she says, is this poem for Mummy's lover? It's someone who loves Mummy, but no, it's not her lover. It's a poem about a daughter who's concerned and upset and trying to deal with her mother being very, very ill.
It's all over the place. Like, I feel it's all over the place, as in it jumps around in terms of what it's saying.
No, it doesn't.
And it jumps around on the trampoline. I'm trying to be artistic here, Paul. There's lots of jumping.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got the feeling that it's maybe a complicated relationship with mummy. Mummy, you know, why was she born? Like, kind of berating that fact. But then again, berating, why does she need to die?
Well, yeah, it's raging against the futility of existence. Oh. And, you know, it's the acceptance of nihilism.
Yes.
You know, what's the point of all this? Why did you make mummy live so you could kill her, so you could, you know, make her die and suffer?
Yeah.
So it's a raging against the dying light of her mother's life.
Okay, and it also is really interesting the way it starts. As soon as mummy hatched, she dressed me in a birdcage.
Yes.
That kind of twisted my mind to the point where it's starting to hurt. As soon as mummy hatched, not me hatching, but mummy hatched, she was dressing me in a birdcage? What's going on?
Well, what's interesting, this first section of the book is very much bird-based.
Okay.
There's lots of poems to do with birds and featuring birds. In fact, the first poem of the book is called Bird's Poetry Book.
Oh.
And she sets out that she and bird are very much connected. Uh-huh. So here we see, you know, this birdcage, for example, and a mother hatching. The birdcage, I think, could be the constrictions of family life.
Okay.
Of family ties, as it were, constrictions of society.
Yeah.
And so we see the bird feature again, and in this poem particularly, we have that worn birdcage. She's actually wearing this birdcage, almost as if she's choosing to be trapped herself, perhaps.
Okay.
And for me, reading, because this kind of poem you want to read a few times. You want to let it settle and digest, as it were. For me, it feels like a bit of a fairy tale.
Uh-huh.
Like she's magically chained to her mother via these chains on her ankles in the birdcage that she's wearing.
Okay.
And also, she seems to be on a quest. She's on a quest to slay the world.
Like slay everything.
Slay the moon, slay the land, slay the forest. Because she feels this injustice at her mother dying.
Okay, she's not accepting it, it feels.
Yeah, but also we know, as the reader, that she cannot succeed.
Mm.
That no matter how much she's trying to rage against nature, that there is no answer and she's still trapped in her birdcage just as her mother is trapped by mortality.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think if we look at the title, Floor is Not a Flaw, she cannot walk when she's outside of her mother's presence. Mm. She's always bouncing on this trampoline as if she cannot be grounded. Oh. She cannot maybe get her roots down or get to grips with what's going on. She's almost weightless in the way that she's being bounced around.
She's all over the place without her mother as that kind of grounding presence.
Perhaps. Yeah, and so it feels to me this is her cry as the daughter who wants the comfort of her mother but can't get that comfort because her mother is the one that's dying. Her mother is the one that is on her deathbed. Aww. And so she has no way to comfort herself. And so it all spurts out in this poem, yeah. This anger and this rage. And this is not a child's rage or a teenager's rage. This is an adult woman, a woman in her 60s perhaps when she wrote this.
Mm.
Herself, an older woman now, yeah, trying to deal with the imminent mortality of her mother and also herself.
It does seem like a stream of consciousness, right? And I really mean that, like, not language, but a stream of consciousness just, yeah, being described. Interesting imagery, right? I would never choose to read something like this personally, but hearing it, yeah, it kind of makes you think in all sorts of different ways, especially with your commentary there, Paul.
Yeah,
thank you.
I mean, I think I was very lucky that when I was at secondary school and then high school,
mm-hmm,
we had to study poetry for English literature.
Yeah.
And we were lucky in that we had to study Sylvia Plath.
Okay.
And for anyone who doesn't know, Sylvia Plath was a brilliant poet, but sadly died very early.
Uh-huh.
She took her own life.
Oh, dear.
And her poems are so powerful and filled with really grotesque and strange imagery.
Mm.
And so being able to study that at school sort of gave me a taste for what poetry could be,
yeah,
and led me to be able to sort of dive in and not be, not be scared or not be sort of a bit put off by poetry that might be a bit more confronting or challenging.
Sure. Okay, so where are we going next?
So for our second poem, it's in the second section, and again, it revolves around her mother, but it's a different view.
Okay.
We have a lot of anger in that first poem.
Yeah.
In this second poem, we have a different attitude, but also a different view of her mother in her final days. It's called Mummy's Expansion. She's a white rabbit, buried in snow. White sheets, white pillows, nice nighty, my mummy. White rabbit lying still under the snow with its paws crossed. Her ears that don't listen to anything have grown up. When I go near them, they become filthy clouds. Like falling snowflakes, like fog on the river, mummy's a bunny that can't be held. Human vegetable. Is this term meant to insult or praise plants? Mummy walks the hospital hallway filled with the souls of human vegetables. Long, long ago, there lived a genius girl. She grew old and turned into a white bunny in her bed. What's your name? I forgot she can barely speak. She became disabled and snow white, growing wider and wider. What will we become after we grow up fierce? We pull out the whitest white bunny from under the blanket and shake it.
Oh dear, this seems a bit sad towards the very end, maybe.
It feels like we're in the final days. Of course, we don't know. She doesn't give us the context of these poems. This is what we have to work out for ourselves.
But comparing the rabbit, the bunny, to her mummy.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, her mother has become this rabbit.
Okay. In what way? Like, when I think of a rabbit, a bunny, I might think of, you know, someone cute, young, full of life, something like that.
But also fragile, easily hurt, easily damaged, destroyed. A rabbit, for me, a white rabbit, I think of purity.
Yeah, of course, bouncing through the snow.
Yeah, I think of innocence. But also there's this sense of transformation. I mean, the most famous white rabbit I think, in the world is probably Alice in Wonderland.
Of course.
And the idea of diving down the rabbit hole of being late, of there being an appointment. Again, we have to look at poetry through our own eyes.
Yeah.
And while the poet may have certain intentions, we always bring our own feelings and our own sentiments to it. The other thing about rabbits is, I'm sure you've talked about on the show before, and we've talked about in literature, like with Cursed Bunny by Bora Chung, that rabbits are a big part of Korean folklore, and Korean mythology and Korean art. So this is an image that will automatically be familiar to a Korean reader, and also, in fact, to readers all around the world.
Yeah, maybe Mum now going back to purity and innocence, maybe the beginning and end of life are similar like that.
Exactly, because we do talk about the second childhood for some who get older. I also wondered whether it was dehumanization.
Okay.
That her mother has become less human because of this illness.
Yeah.
She's become, you know, she can hardly speak now. She's just lying in a bed and she feels wider. It's almost like she's lost the humanity that she had when she was younger and more virile. And also in the last lines of the poem, she says, you know, what will we become after we grow up fierce?
Yeah.
You know, and Kim Hyesun in her poetry, she is very fierce. She is a strong, independent woman. Poet in her writing. And it's like, but after all this, you know, joy and rage and power, I am destined to become something so fragile, like my mother.
Bunny rabbit.
Yeah, something that can't be held, like falling snowflakes, she says, like fog on the river. And she cannot hold on to her mother now. She has to let her go. And so I wanted to pair these two in particular because it's dealing with this process of grief and process of loss, sort of. I'm making up words here, but pre-grief. The idea, when you have a parent that's sick, and you have a parent that you know are in their last, you know, few days or weeks or months, there is this grief before death.
Yes.
Where you know this is coming and it's not here yet, and you're hanging on to that moment, as it were. And it feels like, as when we talk about grief as well, one of the first things that we do is deny. And then there's the anger or the pleading, the begging. And we see that in the first poem. And now in the second poem, we see that rage as well. In the second poem now, we're seeing more of the acceptance, where the true grief is coming, as the poet recognizes truly what her mother is becoming and where what will happen to her mother. There's a lot of heartbreak here, and I know that's not for everyone, and I'm sorry it's the week before Christmas, and I'm bringing you something that could be a little bit sad, but at the same time, Christmas is about family, and it feels appropriate to sort of share these strong feelings.
Absolutely. Aaron's saying it's a powerful way to describe her mother's transition to frailty, and also it maybe sounds like a mother perhaps suffered dementia. Maybe the rabbit could be something representing that as well.
I think there's that fragility there, that sense of the timid rabbit, of the staring wild eyes, never talking, just scared of her environment. We don't know exactly what is going on. We do know in the poem that she can barely speak. She's become disabled. She's sort of on the bed growing wider and wider. But I agree with Aaron. There's a sense of that, that this is a representation of the illness and the damage the illness has done to her mother.
Yeah, Besby also saying very vulnerable. You get that feel. So the last poem we'll hear after a song break is to do with her grandmother.
Yeah, so again, another family connection. We've dealt with the pre-grief, and now in this final poem, she writes about her grandmother after her grandmother's passing.
Okay.
And it's about her relationship with her grandmother and much more. It's called I Want to Marry My Grandma. I didn't have to shut Grandma's eyes so tight. I plant a seed in each seam of Grandma's hemp shroud skirt. The seeds sprout inside the seams. Grandma always said, don't become a cabbage liar. I tend the talking cabbage patch. Someone who sends sweet sticky rain and someone who gets happily drenched in it meat. They say they are crazy in love. They want to marry, each in a white dress for both wedding and funeral. They want to marry. Millions of water flowers bloom in heaven and earth. Rain washes Grandma's legs. A body extends from the mountain north of Seoul to the toll gate in the south. I sit on top of Grandma's forehead and write a line starting with, I remember Grandma 100 times. I think of an umbrella that can cover Grandma's entire body. I think of an umbrella that can cover me and the wedding guests. Grandma, now you have a lot of land. This is all yours. Grandma, when you were alive, you only had one dress to your name. Soon the cabbages that were dangling from the dark sky begin to break open above ground, sticky cabbage heads. The children in the cathedral's dark confessional room press their palms together with fingers pointing up like sunflower seeds. They pray so the dead can never live again. In rain, I think about Grandma whose eyes I'd shut. I think of Grandma and me getting married in rain.
Wanting to marry your grandma, that's an interesting title. Symbolically,
this is, we're not talking about, you know, romantic marriage or anything like that. I think it's more about being able to give her grandmother what she never had when she was alive. That her grandmother has sacrificed so much that she only had a single dress when she was alive.
For wedding and funeral, for the whole life, kind of, maybe, representing.
So poor. And so she's there talking about, you know, what, how she would want to treat her grandmother if she could. And she can't, because she's already closed her eyes, meaning maybe she was there at the moment of death. And she closed her eyes too tightly, sensing that sense of guilt over, what did I do it right? Did I do too much? What's going on with my life?
What's going on with all the cabbages?
It's interesting. Yeah, it's all connected together. And again, this is the sort of poem you need to ruminate on. But it's birth, it's life, it's death, it's nature. You know, the dress for both the funeral and the wedding, the seeds planted in her, the funeral clothes, the cabbages being tended to. And Grandma is now so huge. She's one with nature. She's the size of Seoul.
She's everything.
She's been absorbed by the land. And that absorption into nature, for me at least, is sort of this beautiful and mournful voice of the poem.
This one's a bit more, I don't know, not upbeat, of course, but a bit more positivity in and amongst the grief I can feel.
Yes, and that's why I thought it would be a good one to pair with the other two. So that we're dealing with these three stages of grief, as it were. The rage, the acceptance and the sadness, and then sort of the healing, as it were, that comes after.
Looking back at someone's life, maybe you do feel that guilt initially, don't you? What could I have done better for that person who's no longer here, so you can't do any more for them? And then eventually I think you get over that as well, because that's not a healthy place to sit in for too long.
No, but it's also part of a process. And I think I'm listening to an audiobook this morning where a writer is talking about the passing of her father, and she cared for him in his last days, and talking about how grief comes in different ways and at different times, and it's not a linear process. And I think it all too easily gets summed up for us by other people saying, oh, grief is this. But then when we experience it firsthand, it becomes so personal and so unique to us that it becomes even hard to describe what has happened to us, how we have transformed during the grieving process.
Yeah, Jennifer, again, putting the personal slant on this, this reminds me of how close my grandma and I were. We could always relate to each other, and we always tried to make her feel special, especially when she became homebound.
And I'm sure you did so much, and I'm sure she appreciated it. But I'm sure at the same time, Jennifer, that you and your family at times were thinking, have we done enough? Is this enough? Because that's natural, the natural feeling of guilt or not knowing if what we've done has been enough for everybody.
Yeah. Ray and Siska with similar thoughts saying, you know, poetry is never easy for me. It's quite confusing. But yeah, I think if you're reminded of anything, like Jackie just said about your grandma and your own experiences, like, that's the value of poetry. That can be all you need, right?
Yeah, and it speaks to people in different ways. I would have read this differently when I was 18 compared to how I read it today. And it's the same. It's the same for all of us when it comes to appreciating poetry. It speaks to us at different times in our lives. And I know, again, I'll say it's not necessarily for everyone. But if you're up for a challenge, I think Kim Hesun's poems are brilliant. I guess you would say they're on the intermediate list instead of the beginner's poetry list. You've got to have a bit of experience with poetry to get on with them and to start to really dig into them.
Yeah.
But they are so rewarding when you do. They are confronting, though. But at the same time, whenever I get a new collection of hers, I love the way that she pushes me around as a reader.
Oh, wow.
The way that she forces me to confront certain ideas or aspects or parts of her own life that she reveals to me. And I think the other wonderful thing about this book is the translator's diary at the end, where you get like the DVD extras, the behind the scenes that you don't really think about when you're just reading a translation, that the translator has gone through a lot in terms of wanting to make this poem as impactful as it is in the original language.
Wow, that's really interesting. And like we said, just in the English version, of course. Your one-line review, please, Paul.
A blistering, beautiful, confrontational poetry that bleeds from Kim's heart and makes us consider our own fragility.
Jen also getting in touch saying, grief comes in waves, especially when loved ones are suffering and you're unable to help. Yeah, like you mentioned, that pre-grief period.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe that's the hardest, right? Once a chapter is closed, you kind of get over it and stuff like that. But while they're still there and you're feeling you're not doing enough, but they're there, yeah. Next week's book, what are we going to be taking a taste of?
We've got a short story collection. It's Miss Kim Knows by Cho Nam-joo, translated by Jamie Chang. I'm looking forward to featuring it next week for our final book of the year.
Wow, indeed it is. Well, thank you so much, Paul, for today.
Thanks to everyone. Thanks to the Literature Translation Institute of Korea for the help with the copyright permission for this broadcast. Thank you to Kim Hesun for her incredible poetry and to Donmi Che for her wonderful translation. Of course, happy birthday to Grace. She's still got a few hours left.
Have a very Merry Christmas, Paul, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week with another book.
Bye-bye. You can listen to Check It Out with Paul Matthews on Arirang Radio's hashtag Daily K every Wednesday from 10 a.m. KST.